Chapter 15. Teddy. May 1873. Elizabethtown, New Mexico. George grows more despondent day by day. The slow dawning of our situation eats at him like a worm in a rotten apple. The core is gone. Soon that fat worm will poke its way right out of George's eye socket. We are done for here. I know it. He knows it. Bugby knows it. I always felt it in the pit of my stomach that it would not work out for us here at this mine. The question now is what to do. I have had a letter from Mr. Weir, a personal note, which I was not expecting. He writes to George often, but this one was addressed to me. He says he is in need of a bookkeeper again, and the position is mine. Should I like it? It's very tempting, for I know how the job suits me, and I do miss Chicago. He says the city has been rebuilding quickly. George is sour all day long. He is sour because he says we had the fortune in our grasp, but circumstances tore it away from us. I am not so sure about that. It was unfortunate that the water got turned off just as we nearly finished building that ditch. Almost at bedrock, he repeats it over and over. Almost at bedrock. If the water was still running, I would perhaps be able to take on laundry or something else to earn our keep. George has asked about in town, but no one wants a woman bookkeeper. I can't help but think that if I'd stuck to my plan and my trousers, maybe we wouldn't be in this predicament. I should never have that skirt back on, and George cannot say anything on the days when I do leave it across my chair, for it can be so muddy up here, and it is such a hindrance, especially when you have discovered what it's like not to be bound by it. But if the water was still running, then I guess George and Bugby would be getting to that bedrock, of course, and perhaps there would be no need for doing laundry anyway. Elizabethtown bores us half to death. Yesterday I thought I saw a bear, and even though I know bears can climb trees, I shimmied up a great Scots pine, for I thought if I'm up here he may pass by me and not see me. Thank goodness I was not wearing my skirt. Well, that black bear passed me by, and guess what? It wasn't a bear at all, but a great big black hog. Scared me to hell. This morning we went to town, and when I was in the store, an Indian man came in to trade a bow and three arrows. I could not keep my eyes off him. He was tall, taller than you'd expect most Indians to be, and he smelled of fire smoke and mint all up close. He had the most beautiful woven blanket around him. He wanted $5 for the bow and arrows and wouldn't accept anything less. Mr. Maroney offered to trade him for a large glass of whiskey, as often Indians will take that instead of money and then fall around drunk because they're not made to handle liquor the way white folk are. But the Indian said no. I looked at the bow and arrows and saw that they were quite beautifully made, and thinking of that old black bear and me up the tree and how I could have shot him from the tree, perhaps, I offered him the $5. It was a stupid thing to do with us having very little money, but I could not help myself. I did not think of George and his sourpuss, but that smooth bent bow and that stoic Indian looking at me, his eyes dark and brooding almost. I cannot quite describe it, and I would hate it if anyone read these words that I now write, but a feeling came over me, somewhat like that feeling I had when I first met George, only this was different. This feeling shot through to my very soul. It was as though I'd met him before, but not in this life, but in another. Isn't that something? Something queer. The Indian pushed the bow and arrow over to me, and I took the money out of my purse and I gave it to him. He walked out of the store, his stride big, loping, and then he was gone. I picked up the bow, and Mr. Maroney laughed at me, saying I could have bought the thing for little more than a glass of whiskey, but I knew that Indian man would not have traded. I could tell that he was not one of those Indians to fall around drunk. The bow was solid in my hand, and as we rode back to our cabin, I ran my hands over it, thinking how that Indian must have run his hands over it 1,000 times. He must have made it himself, tapering that cherry wood over and over, tying the sinew up tight. I noticed a simple carving at one end, a zigzag pattern with a crescent moon. I could not hide that bow from George, but neither could I tell him how much I'd paid for it, and so I fibbed and said I parted with only $1 for it. He said I was a foolish woman, and he was growing tired of me up in these mountains. He was silent then for a long time, and I felt quite sorry about my situation and was getting to think how maybe I should take PB up on his offer of Chicago when George announced that a group of miners were leaving Elizabethtown for Virginia City in 2 days' time, and he was going to talk to Bugby about it. For if we didn't leave soon, we would run out of money completely. Virginia City. I don't know much about that place, but it would mean traveling back over the plains. Maybe I am a foolish woman, but somehow I feel readier, like a warrior carrying a piece of that Indian man with me wherever I go. I suppose I don't mind if we do go to Virginia City. I'm tired of these unforgiving mountains, too. I had a bad feeling about this place, and I guess I was right, wasn't I? May 1873, near Pueblo, New Mexico. It is good to be back on the road, and George's spirits have lifted now that adventure is afoot again. He said not a word when I put on my trousers and appeared with my hair all shorn up again, just made that face he always makes when he sees something he doesn't like. Wrinkles his nose right up and frowns. Bugby chuckled to himself, but I sat up on my horse, my bow and arrow on my back. "Did you pack your razor?" Bugby asked, and nearly fell off his mount, laughing so much. I trotted down the side of the mountain, thinking it was all very well for Bugby to find it funny, but he, like George, had lived his whole life in pants and knew nothing of the hardship or the vulnerability of being a young woman on the road. I knew George was thinking that he knew better than me, but from the talk I'd heard, this was no longer the 1848 California gold rush, and you couldn't get away with things like this now that they were making laws and hauling people to court for dressing outside your sex. But the plains were another law unto themselves. I would be fine on the plains, better than fine. We packed what we could of our tools and traded the bigger items in town. I was mighty surprised to see that Indian I bought the bow and arrow off and had turned up as a guide, for we were traveling with members of the U.S. Army to a small town called Denver, then on to Cheyenne, where we would take the Union Pacific west. He didn't take any notice of me, and I guess didn't recognize me in my garb. I did see him eyeing the bow, though. In the mornings, George and I like to take our horses out over the plains for a gallop, for our horses are very fine saddle horses and enjoy the speed over the plains. I will be sorry to say goodbye to my mare at Cheyenne. We have to be careful when we gallop due to the prairie dog holes, which are all around. The holes are inhabited by a type of ground gopher, and they live in large numbers like regular villages under the ground. The entrance to their holes are quite big, and a horse can step in one, stumble, and fall. I saw a rattlesnake at the entrance to one, and our Indian guide, they call him Momo, told us that the rattlesnake, prairie dog, and owl live together in the same hole, and they help warn each other of danger. Later, I did see a little brown owl fly up and flap his wings as we passed, making the most peculiar sound. Imagine having to live in a hole with a rattlesnake! Momo travels with his wife Helki. She is quite beautiful, with sallow skin and her shiny hair plaited down her back. I would like to ask them many questions, but I know George would not like it, and neither likely would the army, too. I know he is a married man. Do Indians marry? Surely not properly like us. But I find the Indian ever so striking. Last night, when I was settling down for the night, I caught sight of him, washing before bed, and he lifted his overshirt, and I was transfixed. I have grown used to George's torso and Bugby's too, for they worked shirtless in the summer on the ditch. But this was different. It recalled to me a passage from reading Anne Radcliffe. "There is something in the eloquence of silence that charms the imagination more than words." My imagination felt suddenly like the 4th of July, like 4th of July firecrackers. I wanted to run right up to him and embrace him, to lay my head against him, to sniff and smell and feel him, for the muscles on his stomach were hard, like pats of butter from the icebox. Oh, such words! It is just as well that George is not very literate and would never think to read my scribblings, thank goodness. I hope I dream tonight of the Indian. It would not be the first time I have dreamt of Momo. Something terrible happened. We are all still quite in shock. The road is an unforgiving place. Take it at your peril. It all started at bedtime 2 nights ago when Bugby got to drinking some whiskey with the army soldiers. George was not too happy about this, for he said Bugby could not hold his liquor. And indeed, I have seen in our time in Elizabethtown when he would take to the saloon like a man with a fire inside him, a fire that could only be quenched by liquor. When we awoke this morning, Bugby's horse was gone, as was he. The soldiers had not seen him, but said that he had been weaving all about last night, a man in a terrible state. Momo held up his tin cup at breakfast and tapped it at the halfway mark and told us that Bugby had filled his cup with whiskey up to there and drank it. George and I knew that if Bugby had drank all that, he would have been quite legless. We saddled up to go and look for him. George and I in one direction, Momo and somewhat guilty-looking soldier in another. We met on top of a ridge a mile from camp, and from the ridge we spotted Bugby's horse grazing, but no sign of Bugby. We spread out again, and it was George, who found him lying on his back in the middle of a big bunch of cactus. We tried to get him up, but we could not arouse him. His buck-skinned gloves and his clothes were full of cactus thorns. He was breathing heavily like a man snoring, though he didn't seem in restful sleep. He was quite unconscious. The men got him across his horse, and we led him back to camp. Momo said his horse probably stepped in a prairie dog hole, stumbled, and had thrown him a complete somersault down the ridge, which was why he was lying on his back. He didn't say somersault, of course, but this is what we devised from his gestures. Momo's English is sparse, but he speaks Spanish well, which I've been taking up readily myself. There was nothing for it but to put him on the wagon. We arrived at Denver at about 5 o'clock, which is a small town, much smaller than Pueblo, with only one street running through it and perhaps 50 small adobe houses on both sides. A doctor was fetched, but he said we needed to prepare ourselves, for Bugby's neck was broken. Oh, how wretched we all felt. Poor Bugby. Poor, stupid, drunken Bugby. The doctor allowed him to stay in his surgery, for he said it would not be long, the traveling and putting him over the horse having done his broken neck no favors whatsoever. He did not seem in pain, but remained altogether unconscious. George asked me to say my prayers over him, for I feel they must have brought him some comfort. Distraught was he at this tragedy to strike us. I held poor Bugby's hand as he passed, George by my side, white as an apparition. He did not shed a tear, but he was very shaken, for he and Bugby, and I too, naturally, spent much time together on that mountain outside Elizabethtown. "He never did find his gold," George choked after he'd breathed his last, and I wondered, did it make George now more determined than ever to succeed? For Bugby. Momo, who was waiting outside, for he is very loyal like that, and I took our horses back toward camp, for George wanted to sit alone with Bugby for a time, which we understood. We were to return the next day to dig a grave for Denver, his final resting place. Something happened which I quite fear writing down, and so I will write it in code, for which I and only I know the key. Coded. I don't know who you are to find the code and able to read this. The reason for the code is to protect my dear George, who I do care for so, and who I know would be utterly dejected were he to discover these truths about me. However, I must write them down, as I fear if I don't, I shall simply burst. It is, of course, all to do with my dear Momo, for the tension has been building for quite some time between us, and as he steadied my horse for me to get astride in Denver, his hand fell to the bow that I keep tied there, and he ran his hands over it, looking somewhat quizzical, and asked if he could see it, to which I agreed, and he unpinned it and examined it and declared, "Mine." And he pointed at himself and said, "Molimo." I suppose that is his full name. I nodded and took off my hat and shook out the hair that I have left, and on his face there was a dawning, and he said, "Elizabethtown." And I nodded again, and then, all at once, it was as though he saw me for the first time. I was no longer a young, threadbare man on his journey across the plains, but that forward young woman he'd met that day at the store, the thoughtful woman who understood that such a bow and arrows were worth more than a damned glass of whiskey. I am still grappling with what happened next, but tragedy and joy can happen in one day. As Momo looked into my face in that dark Denver street, it seems that I, not he, approached, for there and then we embraced and kissed passionately, and his lips were all over my face and mine all over his. I felt as if I could devour him there and then. We secured our horses and rushed behind an adobe wall, kissing again and again and again. "Your wife," I said, and he seemed quite confused. "What about your wife?" I asked again. "No wife," he said. Then I said, "Helki?" And he laughed and laughed and laughed. "Sister," he said. Then it was my turn to laugh. I was so terribly fearful that George would come out then and find our horses tethered and wonder what on earth we were up to, and so I did not want to delay longer, and we rode back to camp. Momo said he was very happy to be reunited with his bow and arrows, and the reason he had sold them in the first place was to send money back to his tribe, who have been facing famine. I presumed that his tribe were from nearby, but he explained that his tribe was from California, on the coast, and he and Helki had traveled a long way, as his job as an army scout can take him anywhere. He said his tribe were now very scattered, and that he did not want to be a scout, that he would much rather be back with his tribe. I felt quite sorry for this handsome native man, so far from home. I went to sleep that night, and later felt George bed down beside me and felt quite guilty at the night's events. They say shock can make you do strange things, but this strange thing that happened, I could do it again and again and again forever. George must not find out anything whatsoever. Momo and I must keep our delicious secret to ourselves. No one will suspect him of kissing the young man on his trail so passionately. No one suspects young men of much at all. It is the women they always watch, and I have cleverly taken all eyes off me. Yesterday, Helki's horse stumbled into a prairie dog hole, and she was thrown quite badly. We are experiencing some terrible luck on this journey. She damaged her wrist and leg as she landed awkwardly on her left side. We put her in the wagon like we had done Bugby, and she asked me to fetch her skin bag she carries, in which she revealed many dried herbs and powders, some lumpy, peppered with bark and berries. I made her a tea under her instructions, which she took for pain relief. She told me her wrist and ankle are broken. The army sergeant said when they get to Cheyenne they will have it looked at, but I felt he could quite easily have forgotten the native woman as much as fetch her a doctor. Native women are not seen the same as white women. She is but a burden now, as her purpose with us as a medicine woman was as a medicine woman. Momo is terribly worried. If she can't ride, it's impossible for her to travel on with the army, for they simply will not cart her around in a wagon, unable to do her job. Soon we will all be parted. Coded. As we will reach Cheyenne soon, I let my emotions come over me, and I have given him my all. I do not regret it, not one bit. I felt delirious afterwards. I am secretly a true, full woman now. How can I now be separated from such a man? How cruel life is, how wretched I feel thinking about it. But I must hide my tears from George. He would never understand, and even if he did, I am not sure my good companion would care. We have reached Cheyenne. Our train leaves tomorrow, west. A doctor confirmed the fracture in Helki's wrist and ankle and has splinted her wrist and wrapped her leg. He is worried the ankle has dislocated and that infection could set in. She is taking her herb medicine to prevent infection. I told her if she bottled it, she could sell it, as she is getting great relief and does not complain. They are in quite the bind now, for Momo is still contracted for another 6 months. It is a pity she cannot travel with us. I have grown close to her in the past few days. She has a beautiful, settled spirit, quite dignified. Goodness, George surprises me when I least expect it. It was he who suggested Helki travel with us to Virginia City. I am questioning whether Bugby's death has softened him. Helki will take the rail car with us, for she really is not fit for horse or wagon. Momo will meet her in Virginia City when his contract ceases, and they are happy with this arrangement, for they are getting nearer and nearer to the coast where their people are. It is quite sad what Helki told me about their Miwok tribe. There is only a handful left. She explained that even before the gold rush, settlers took Miwok lands and killed many of the tribe. I could not imagine it, such barbarism. Since last century, the missionaries arrived to convert them and others, but her family resisted, for it was well known that the missions brought great diseases that could not be cured. She said it's the reason she and Momo left for the trails, at least they could be free. George says that now we have ended our journey on the plains. I should return to dressing like a young woman, for it is too dangerous to tempt fate any longer, but I have argued that we should see how Virginia City pans out first. He does not want me to be taken for a common prostitute. I told him with my soft face and body, for I really do carry small, that I can pass for a young man very well, and he need not worry. Tomorrow, Helki will say goodbye to Momo. I expect she will be very sorrowful. July 1873, Granger, Wyoming. George does not understand what saddens me so. How can one endure such heartache? September 1873, Virginia City, Nevada. Oh, how we have grappled these past months to make our life here. Virginia City has not been as lucrative as we expected. George has bought many stocks and even traded some, but the times where he made a sum for himself ended up lost again through bad trades or useless mines. I have refused to go back to my dress, much to George's dismay, and taken jobs working mines to support us. The work is harder than I could ever have imagined. The shaft I work currently goes 2,000 feet into the ground, and each day I am lowered down like a rat in a bucket, straight into the mouth of the furnace. The heat is unbearable. The men work in overalls and nothing else, but I, of course, cannot take off my shirt. They rib me and say I have something to hide. They have large tanks of ice water in the lower levels, and we are obliged to stop and throw the water over us regular, and each time I am terrified they will see my bindings underneath, and so I only wear dark clothes. We are saving to buy more stocks. We must try to pull ourselves up. George always believed he would dig his own lucrative mine, not work someone else's. Helke's arm has mended, and she has set up a small laundry and is out the door with both laundry and medicine work. Last week, when we counted up our wages, we discovered that she earned more than George. He is most despondent, and yet he is very fond of Helke. I am feeling most tired. Ever since we got to Virginia City, I've had to haul myself out of bed in a manner I have never experienced. My body aches. My head is weary. Helke gives me teas. They help, but sleep is only a moment, and then it is time to rise again. October 1873, Virginia City, Nevada. George wishes me to leave the mine and run the laundry with Helke so we can increase our loads. We fear the water is bad here in the city and is making me sick and tired. George has come to work in the mine with me. His stocks have failed again, and the mine he was working turned out to be redundant. I preferred it when I was alone down there, for I feel he is watching me closely all day long. November 1873, Virginia City, Nevada. My tiredness is gone. I have a renewed vigor. I feel bright and look forward to the future, despite the hardships here. Our seam has proved valuable, and we have finally drawn down some. I always felt this mine would pay off. Helke has expanded her laundry business, though her hands are raw and her wrist continues to be a bother. I'm not sure if she can continue at such a pace much longer. George has lost much weight, and yet I have gained some. We joke that he has sent it right on over to me. I think George may be sweet on Helke. They laugh and whisper together, and she makes him a soothing tea each evening before bed. There has been no word from Momo. I dream about him. Sometimes, on the breeze, I feel that he is with me, his spirit guiding me. George tells me he thinks I'm half Indian. I take it as a compliment. December 1873, Virginia City, Nevada. Oh, wretched day! Oh, cursed, wretched day! I am at sea. I am lost to the gods. I will not recover from this. All is lost. Foolish woman, foolish, foolish woman. George is making arrangements for us to leave immediately. I await his beating. It is what I deserve. How we shall come back from this. We are leaving Virginia City. It is the only way. Oh, wretched, wretched day. And then in between chapters 15 and 16, we have this clipping from the Virginia City Bugle. December 13th, 1873. Woman discovered down mine. A most shocking event occurred in the O'Reilly shaft on Thursday A most shocking event occurred in the O'Reilly shaft on Thursday last after the discovery of a young woman disguised as a man caused consternation among the miners. The young woman, who donned a hat and overshirt despite the raging heat, is thought to have been working in the mine for some 4 months now, never revealing her identity and thoroughly fooling all that made her acquaintance. The shocking discovery was made at 2,000 feet below ground after a minor accident which shunted two buckets together, injuring the young woman in question. When the miners came to her assistance and insisted on examining her for injuries, the shocking discovery made. Reports also suggest that the young woman may be with child. One worker told this reporter that the miners are resentful of being fooled so and ran the young woman out of the mine. It is believed the woman's husband was also working the mine and that both, along with a native woman they employ, have fled town. The owner of the mine did not respond for requests for commentary on this shocking and quite unprecedented turn of events.